Hey man, this is Kevin Smith, Silent Bob from all those terrible Jay and Silent Bob type pictures, and you are listening to Thinking Outside the Long Box, comics talk for comics fans.
We're on the road, we're going home, to the place where wild nerds roam, with pretty girls and dudes and kids, going to cons is our
everybody, and welcome to the Long Box, guys. My name is Tom Strange, and with me, as always, are some of my best friends since I was a wee little guy. Mikey, what are you doing and what are you drinking?
I am doing fine, Tom, and I am drinking Strongbow Hard Apple Cider. What are you drinking, Tom?
Today, I am drinking what I call a Strange Tale. A Strange Tale is when I mix three or four different scotches together in one glass because they're the dregs. Also sometimes known as a Harvey Bullock. Tommy, what are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking some lovely Glenlivet 15-year-old French Oak Reserve.
Josh, what do you got over there?
I have a Dogfish Head Blood Orange IPA. That's pretty delicious.
I can't tell you how great it felt the first time I read The Watchmen. And I think you guys will agree with me that it's one of the great graphic novels of all time, one of the great comic books of all time, and something that every nerd should read. Now, usually we get into, you know, the background, stories, and different issues, but since The Watchmen is one graphic novel, today what we're going to do is we're just going to talk about some of our favorite parts, why The Watchmen is important, what effect it had on comic books, and whatever else comes to mind while we drink and talk about this great comic book. Mike, do you want to give us like a very, very short synopsis of what The Watchmen is?
Sure. The Watchmen was a 12-issue series published by DC Comics from 1986 to 1987. It was written by Alan Moore with art by Dave Gibbons and colors by John Higgins. It was edited by friend of the podcast, Barbara Kessel, and also a guy named Len Wein.
God rest his soul.
God rest his soul. It has been described as the greatest graphic novel of all time. Time magazine put it in one of the top 100 American novels of all time. And Alan Moore is considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest, graphic novel writers of all time. He cut his teeth in the United Kingdom writing a series called Marvel Man, which was a revival of an old comic they had, which was a ripoff of the Captain Marvel story. They didn't have the rights from Fawcett to use it, so they just blatantly ripped him off and created Marvel Man. Then he came over to the U.S., started doing work for DC Comics, particularly on Swamp Thing. And then he just started killing it by writing graphic novels. First, The Watchmen, followed up later on by things like The Killing Joke, From Hell, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and something, V for Vendetta. And another
top
one that
10.
He actually started his own comic line called America's Best Comics, which featured his Promethea and the aforementioned Top 10. And he also wrote a graphic novel I'd never heard about, and I think, Tom, you should explain it to our folks, called Lost Girls.
Lost Girls. Lost Girls is a terrific graphic novel if you're someone who likes to masturbate. Now, I am what most people would call a masturbation enthusiast. I think it's healthy to explore your sexuality while you're by yourself, if that's what you feel like doing. And this graphic novel will help you in a lot of ways. It reimagines a world where Dorothy, Alice from Alice in Wonderland, Little Red Riding Hood, a lot of these female characters are hyper-sexualized characters trying to survive in a very violent world that often sees them getting tied up and their clothes ripped off. I think that's a nutshell, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I see what you did there.
You nailed it.
I don't really think there's a lot else to go there. He's not winning an Eisner for that one. He's certainly not winning any feminist awards for it either. But some of the artwork in there really is breathtaking. Even the background, besides, you know, it's very reminiscent of the What was that all-girl action-adventure one? That was, come on, don't leave me hanging, guys. You guys
A-Force? Are
good. No, they were spies. It was the same
Danger
graphics.
Girl?
Danger Girl, thank you very much. It's very much reminiscent of the artwork of Danger Girl. Almost the exact same stuff. I'm guessing some of the artists probably worked on both, but I'm not sure right off the top of my head. But they certainly do look a lot alike. Yeah, they're hypersexualized and a little bit stupid, but both have their merits in their own stupid ways.
Well, in addition to Lost Girls, of course, we're talking about The Watchmen, and The Watchmen is amazing because Moore was able to deconstruct both the superhero genre and the Cold War idea of paranoia of mutually assured destruction. He originally planned to use Archie comic characters, the Mighty Crusaders, and have a murder mystery centered around the body of the Shield being found in a harbor. But thank God he pitched the idea to DC Comics instead. DC had just purchased the rights to the superheroes from Charlton Comics. Moore was going to use them, but managing editor Dick Giordano... Did I say that right?
Yeah, Giordano.
Yeah.
Said it better than I've ever said it.
He convinced Moore to create new characters rather than destroy a bunch of heroes DC had just paid a bunch of money to get the rights to. So I'm going to quiz you guys and see if you can tell me who the characters from The Watchmen are loosely based on. For both their Charleston comic characters and other comic book characters. We'll start with Tom, the comedian.
The comedian, that's a toughie. I don't know why you're doing that. I mean,
because you'll find out in a second.
All right, Josh, I'm going to pass. Pass, Josh.
The Shield. Mike just told you the answer 12 seconds ago.
No.
It's not the Shield, Josh.
It's not the Shield.
Yeah, it was probably more of a conglomeration, a little bit between like the Heckler and maybe the Question.
No, you are so wrong. LT, you want to take a stab at it?
I do not want to take a stab at it.
It was the Charleston comic character, the Peacemaker. And
I don't know that one.
He mixed him in with the spy, Nick Fury.
Huh, okay.
That's where he got the eye patch from.
I can see the Nick Fury crossover.
A little bit of Nick Fury in the visuals.
All right, well, Tom, I'll throw you the easy one then. Rorschach, because you already said the answer.
I already said the answers, so what did I just say? God dang it. So I said the Question, which yep. was the obvious one for them. Yep. But Rorschach was a little more layered than the Question. I'm not sure who else to throw in on that one.
I did not even know what this character
Jughead?
Exists. No, I didn't even know this character existed, but it's a guy named Mr. A that Steve Ditko had created for a small independent magazine. So I never heard of him before, so don't feel bad about not getting that one.
Okay.
LT, who was the Night Owl based on?
Why is he the easy one?
I don't really know the Charleston comics, but I always thought he was kind of a Batman character. He seems like the Batman-ish character in the comic. He's rich. He's independently wealthy. He designed a lot of his own gear. You know, he always seemed to be parallel to sort of Batman.
That is a great guess, but it's totally wrong. It is the Blue Beetle. Yes, Ted Kord specifically, although his mentor, Dan Garrett, also appears in the form of Hollis Manson in the comic book. What about Ozymandias?
Ozymandias. I'm gonna lateral to Tom here.
I'm going to guess maybe a Doc Strange, a Doc Savage type character.
Kind of. It is Peter Cannon Thunderbolt.
Yeah. I remember the comic book a little bit, but I never would have gotten that name.
So,
and only from pictures, not from like whole comics.
All right, I'll just throw this one out there. Anybody want to guess on Dr. Manhattan?
Who they based Dr. Manhattan on?
Mandrake?
Spectre?
No, it's the Charleston Comics characters.
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know any of the Charleston Comics ones.
It would be Captain Atom, although I think he's more similar to Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom.
Oh, now Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom, I remember.
What about the Silk Spectre?
I'm thinking of Phantom Lady, but there was someone before Phantom Lady?
The Fury?
Yeah, it's the Charleston comic character was Nightshade, but Alan Moore hated Nightshade and thought she was horrible, so he actually made her more of an amalgamation of the Phantom Lady and Black Canary because of the whole mother-daughter issue going on with the generations. Good job, guys.
Thanks. We were zero for six. It reminds me of a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle quiz we took once. All right, so that's the very basics of, you know, the background, but we never got into the basics of what the story is about. Josh, do you think you can give us a Reader's Digest super synopsis?
Absolutely. So, quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who watches the watchman? So, in its very basic entirety, the watchman is a murder mystery. Sorry?
You didn't look at notes for that, you son of a bitch. Did you have that memorized?
No, I had to look that up earlier today.
Okay, keep going, sorry.
I couldn't remember it, honestly. And I couldn't remember how to pronounce quis correctly, so I did look that up as well. I admit it. I had to look it up. My Latin's rusty. The Watchmen depicts basically an alternate history where costume vigilantes emerge in the 1940s and change early U.S. history. In the course of that, the country becomes increasingly paranoid about what these guys are doing without oversight. The Keene Act is implemented, and superheroes are outlawed. And in the present day of the comic, the only two heroes still working for the U.S. government are the Comedian and Dr. Manhattan. Now, the story also is really just a nice noir murder mystery about the murder of Edward Blake, the Comedian, one of the last heroes still working for the government. And Rorschach, who is really the only operating vigilante outside of the government, is trying to track down who killed the Comedian, and he believes that somebody is going after ex-heroes, and so he goes to find all the Watchmen and warn them that they might be killed. And just as another aside, the world in its essence, almost all of the heroes are just costumed individuals, and while they might be peak human physical fitness and whatnot, Dr. Manhattan is one of the only people who exhibit actual superpowers, really being like energy and matter.
I would add Osmandius there, if you count hyperintelligence as a superpower.
He is.
But only extraordinary level.
And it's intimated throughout the book that there are people with psychic abilities, and they mention Moloch and his abilities, and they also, in the how Ozymandias manipulates the world, mentioned how it affects psychics across the planet. But they never actually – I don't think there's ever a hero who is ascribed psychic powers in any of the Watchmen. But they do exist in the world.
That was a great synopsis. I'm so glad I didn't ask LT for that because we'd still be going. And if we had Mike do it, we never would have finished, actually. So let's deconstruct some of our favorite parts of this book, or even just a favorite character. Everyone knows my favorite character on this one was easily Rorschach. I often will play as Rorschach. Just a terrific character. Refused to give up the mask when the Keene Act was enacted and refused to work for the government. He remained true only to one person, that is to himself, even to the end when everyone was advising him to, I suppose we should say spoiler alert at some point, because we're going over the whole comic. Even when it became clear that the end of the big enactment, the thing that happened in New York, the nuclear attack or the alien attack, was just part of Osmandius' plan to unite the world. He was going to tell the world anyways, even though it was best not to. He was still going to tell the world because it was the truth. This is a man with conviction beyond all reason, and I respect him for that, and I also mourn his death for that. Anyone else have a favorite character other than Rorschach? Because I don't know how you could. And my favorite line. My favorite line was, "You think you're locked in here with me? I'm locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me." I love that.
So my favorite line from Rorschach might be, "Never despair, never surrender." I'm pretty sure the guys from Galaxy Quest stole that from him.
I'm going to agree. Yeah, on Galaxy Quest. Yep. Total steal.
I like that Rorschach was convinced that the world was going to end soon, and yet every day he would go to the newsstand and you know, request his New Frontiersman newspaper, even though he was convinced that the world was going to end that day.
So there was some hope left.
So I think my favorite Rorschach quote is, and I'm going to guess at this one, is, "We're all puppets, Lori. I'm just a puppet who can see the strings."
Yeah, that was a nice one.
Yeah.
Mikey says we're all in the Rorschach teat.
I have a number of quotes that I wrote down. "The city is dying of rabies. Is best I can do is wipe the random flecks of foam from its lips." And then "I leave the human cockroaches to discuss their heroin and child pornography." Yeah, Rorschach's a happy-go-lucky character who just sees the best in the world.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he thinks everybody is horrible, and he's not disappointed.
It's true.
Although, I got to say, Ozymandias, I did not see it coming. Of course, this is 1986, but when he is telling his master plan to Night Owl and Rorschach, they're like, "Well, we're going to stop you." He's like, "What? I'm not some cheap villain who's telling you his master plan. I did this a half hour ago."
This is done, son.
It's already happened.
You're in the middle of nowhere.
You guys flew to the Arctic, dude. I did this like an hour. I started a 30-minute countdown 2 hours ago. Like, I'm done. I'm just fucking drinking a beer.
Did you guys hear that bell?
With my giant Kit Kat.
My pizza rolls are done. I did it and had time to make pizza rolls.
This is the celebration party.
And he is the world's smartest man. Still bites into the first pizza roll, and the hot thing still burns the inside of his mouth. It happens to everyone. No one can avoid it. That's just the way it is. That's just pizza roll law.
Pizza roll. First one's awful.
I've got to say, though, that even though, you know, Rorschach had this kind of definitive sort of never give up dog with a bone in his trying to cleanse society of all of its evil doing and wrongness, despite hating all of it, I really kind of liked the linear progression of Dr. Manhattan. I mean, he started out in love with this girl and being ready, and as Dr. Manhattan continued along his path, he just became more and more detached with everything in the world. And there was just kind of this sort of like everything in Dr. Manhattan's world was just sort of ordered, and he just became more and more of Dr. Manhattan until the end of the book. And the quote that I remembered the most about Dr. Manhattan was, "I am tired of this world, these people. I am tired of being caught in the tangle of their lives," when he just kind of exiles himself and decides to detach from the world. And I kind of like that character.
So in the vein of Dr. Manhattan, the thing I find interesting for him is that he sees an unrelativistic view of time. So he sees both his past and his available future at the same time. Now, there are two sort of versions that we're looking at. And in the comic book, Ozymandias sets up a tachyon field, but only around the places he wants to hide from Dr. Manhattan. So Dr. Manhattan can only not see his future when he goes to those places, where in the film, it blocks all of his sort of pre-science. He doesn't see any of the future because it's sort of made fuzzy by tachyons. So in those two differences, I think, are actually pretty important for the character. So like I was talking about, I don't know if we talked about the film Arrival, and I don't know if I talked about the Nash principle. So the Nash principle, our viewers know, and I'm going to diatribe here a little bit, and Mike, you can cut this out if it's too long, is basically a game theory where if all the players know all the possible outcomes but still choose the most favorable outcome given all the options, that is how you design a game around the Nash principle to make things level and balanced. Or if there's a negotiation or some strategic value to something, looking backwards in time and using the Nash principle to see what other outcomes are possible. That's sort of how Dr. Manhattan has to live. And so he knows that Lori's going to leave him, right? There's nothing he can do since he knows every possible outcome for every decision he could make. He still knows Lori's a human. That's sort of ununderstandable. That's why he comes to the conclusion that humanity is so unique and he needs to save it, because even regardless of how many millions of possible outcomes there were, even with her tragic past and her tragic sort of creation, she became someone or something, or the only thing that Dr. Manhattan loves. And knowing that really makes him sort of an interesting and sort of a sad character, where he knows no matter what choices he makes, he has millions and millions of choices, and no matter what he does, he loses the woman he loves and he loses the planet, even after he becomes reattached to it when he realizes what a miracle the birth of an individual is.
The word you were looking for was tragic. He's a tragic character.
Yeah. Though I do like how Moore was able to – I think it was the third or fourth issue of the series where Moore tells it from Manhattan's point of view. So you are constantly cutting in to different times in Manhattan's life, because that's how Manhattan is actually experiencing everything all at the same time. I thought that was brilliant the way he did that. And I also think that the way the art was done was also amazing. They decided to go with the 9-panel boxes for most of the series, and rather than the big splash pages and everything. And that staccato rhythm really played well when you're talking about the issue with the time jump, because it's jarring, just like the time jump is.
Yeah, their absolute consistency with the 9-panel for all the color parts were great. I mean, they had the inserts with the documentation,
right?
Yeah. But for the except for that and the overplay of the comedian's badge, they wholeheartedly stuck to the 9-panel frames, and that really made it. I think Mike's right. It overlaid the consistency of the world with the characters and made that comic very unique even for the time.
That's a good insight. I had not thought about that before, and now that I'm thinking about that, I can definitely see how that plays a big part. Moving on to another character, I really like the Silk Spectre. I loved her fighting style. I loved her creation. I really liked everything about this character, except for the miniseries that came later. We won't talk about that, though, and maybe in another podcast, awful miniseries based on something brilliant. Anyone have any thoughts on the Silk Spectre?
I think not my favorite character. I honestly, the way they portrayed her is not it's probably one of my least favorite parts of the graphic novel, in my opinion, where she's a woman clearly in a man's world in the 60s, and I just don't like the way they treated her as a character. Not going to be able to verbalize that enough.
A lot of times she acted like she didn't even want to be there. She was just there because of her mother. When she takes control at the end of the comic and she starts talking about her new costume, she's talking about, you know, leather and plating and a very unfeminine costume that, you know, she's talking about taking her power back and not just being, you know, the gorgeous, beautiful girl in the high heels and the costume. So I kind of like that progression for her character. And I thought that was interesting. And there are things to like. All right, here's a bit of Watchmen trivia. We'll throw this in every once in a while. who was, according to Watchmen lore, the first mass vigilante. Not criminal, but mass vigilante.
Was that Hooded Justice?
It was Hooded Justice. Mike, everyone else take a drink.
Oh, don't leave me out. I got it right.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a reward for Mike. Everyone else can't drink for a minute. Mike, pound.
Okay.
Pound Town. Mike's going to Pound Town.
Mike, you can go to Pound Town. The rest of us have to see with our cold drinks getting warm in our hand.
This is a bad
segue. Right.
This is a bad segue, but speaking of Pound Town, Alan Moore loves...
Are we going to talk about the rape?
Yep. You cannot read a freaking Alan Moore novel without a rape being in there. What the hell is up with that, Alan Moore? I know Alan Moore is part of the Long Box Legion and is listening to this podcast. So Alan,
yeah, within his underground lair.
That's right. If you could please write to us at luckybastard@outsidethelongbox.com. We would really appreciate if you could explain why you have rape in just about every one of your graphic novels.
The problem in his email is there'll be a rape scene.
Yeah. I was about to say, well, we'd love to have you on a panel.
Everything you write.
Yeah, well, LT's the one who has to read that, so. Yeah.
His kid's first, like, third grade teacher review, he just wrote that teacher letter, rape scene in it.
His grocery list is disgusting.
I am not getting carrots. I'm not getting them.
And no one's having the pie.
First time his lawn guy went to cash the check, they looked at the memo line and were like, what the hell did you do for this? $20.
You're a monster. Wait, was that on a pirate ship?
We should talk about the comic book within the comic book, though. That is an excellent. Did you guys like the pirate adventure?
There were parts of it that I liked.
At the time, when I was a much younger man, I found it distracting. Going back and reading it as a more mature reader, I understood that he was making a point within a point. The pirate ship was showing how someone loses their faith, how someone turns to madness when nothing but madness is around them, and despair feeds upon despair, feeds upon despair. I got that later. At the time, though, the black ship was just distracting to me.
Yeah, I'll admit, when I read this verse in 1986, I skipped over a lot of that. I was like, this doesn't seem important. Blah, 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 blah.
This does not seem important.
No one's wearing a cape. Oh. I like capes and masks. That was me, too.
Yeah, I agree. I think I choked through it the first time I read it. But I was like, I get that this is replacing superhero comics in this world, but why do I have to read it?
Choked through it the first time I read it is the name of an Alan Moore short story. I'm going to take a nap after that joke.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an odd dichotomy when you're reading it the first time and you are a young reader time. You're right. It's one of those things where until you have the time and the inclination to really read something for what it's trying to do and not just the entertainment value, you know, it's like, you know, it's my first year as a philosophy student. I was reading things to write reports about them. I wasn't reading things like a philosopher. And I felt that the same way about that comic. Yep.
Yeah, this is a kind of a tricky comic book in two ways, and that is analogy I sometimes make to, you know, people is it wasn't just a candy bar, it was also a power bar. You know, a candy bar you eat in one sitting and you love it and it's delicious. Sometimes you got to fight your way through a power bar. You know, you need to finish it. It's your power bar. You just went to the gym. You need the thing. You know, a power bar is not nearly as much fun to eat sometimes, but. That this was both a power bar and a candy bar. If you just skipped the black ship, if you skipped some of the documentation, some of the early news reports, it goes by a lot quicker.
Yeah. Also, reading it at the time, I think I was probably mid to late high school when I read it. So it was probably 89 or 90. Still, you know, only a few years after the source material. But since, you know, I was 16 or 17 and – this is pre-internet, like Watergate wasn't a thing that was in my sphere of knowledge, right? Like a lot of the things that were happening in the comic book, the a lot of the Vietnam references, a lot of the historical and political references. This was not information easily collected as a young reader to find the references about, right? It's not, I was getting, you know, an update to Encyclopedia Britannica every 2 years. But seriously, like, you had to, like, if you really wanted to know, like, you had to go read microfiche or talk to your parents. And God forbid you actually talk to your parents, a 15-year-old human being.
Real quick, I know we have some very, very young listeners out there. So Uncle Tom is going to explain to you what the world was like before Google.
And what cabin he lived in.
And what cabin I lived in. So look that up. It's easily Googleable. This is what the world was like back when Uncle Tom was in high school. If you couldn't remember who the drummer was from Whitesnake, you were just kind of fucked. You know, you could call your buddy Josh, or you can call your buddy Mike, or you can wait for a record store to open, but there was absolutely nothing else for it except to sit there and go, who the fuck was that guy's name? And for those of you who don't know who Whitesnake is, now you can Google it. And Google Tawny Katane while you're at it. She made Whitesnake what they are. Why is everyone Googling?
Because now I got to know his name.
I don't want to know his name.
It's Tommy Aldridge. Fuck off, y'all. It's Tommy Aldridge.
I'm sorry. I was just watching the Whitesnake video. I didn't really care about who the drummer was.
Well, thank you for muting your mic.
I was about to go again.
Oh, well, there you go. Again. Are you going to be with someone?
For now.
So.
No, you're going to be on your own.
Yeah. I'll drink to that. It's not easy to get a Whitesnake reference in. We got several of them. Good job, yeah, guys.
Thank you.
So one of my favorite characters was Rorschach's psychiatrist. Because interviewing Rorschach wrecked his marriage. Trying to get into the psyche of Rorschach was just too much for him. And he tried to keep a positive outlook, even though his wife was, let's just face it, quite a bitch.
Sure.
It wrecked his whole outlook on life.
It did not wreck his whole outlook on life, because at the end, he went to go try to save the woman who was being beat up. Of course, you know, the monster appeared and killed him and everybody there. But that's beside the point. He stayed true and tried to make the world a better place. He was the exact opposite of Rorschach, who viewed the world as horrible. He viewed the world as all potential good.
He definitely had the hero's journey as a hero. I mean, he stayed true to himself. As long as we're talking about minor characters that people liked, I would have to put my vote in for Big Deal. There was only two villains in the book mentioned that I can remember off the top of my head, and that was Zolak and Big Deal, and I loved Big Deal.
Zolak was a video game. Moloch.
Moloch, sorry. Thank you.
Who was Big Deal? I don't remember Big Deal.
Big Deal is the little person who was in jail.
Prison. Oh, yeah.
In prison. Who was presumably drowned in a toilet. No little body was ever found. So we don't know for sure.
Can never know for sure. But
I gotta use the bathroom. Now. Prison break. Now. I do a pretty good Rorschach. I should just do Rorschach. I'll do the rest. This is Rorschach. You're not podcasting with me. I'm podcasting with you.
That's true.
I should switch that. Any other minor characters that everyone liked? The original Night Owl, I thought, was a great character too.
Yeah. Hollis Mason, the original Night Owl, right?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Yeah. His stories of the old days and his sort of recollection of the people who came before him is a great part of the whole story. And really just the mythology of the vigilante throughout the books. And it gives Hollis Mason really gives you the backstory into actually caring about why these people can't do what they do anymore. So he's really an emotional connection to the past for the whole novel, for the whole book. Yeah.
Okay, here's the next Watchmen trivia for you guys. Who was the first sponsored superhero?
Silk Spectre.
Dollar Bill.
Dollar Bill for the win. Ding, ding, ding.
Way
LT,
to go, Tom.
You get to pout. And Josh, for a secondary prize, how'd he die?
Oh, is he the guy who got his cape caught in the revolving door?
No capes!
No capes! And I have to say, yeah, complete sidebar, the sequel to The Incredibles, probably my most anticipated movie of 2018.
Oh, I got a friend of mine who did some of the work on it, and she got this cool lithograph, and I told her, you know, my jealousy is palpable. You could palp it. You could spread this on toast and eat it. I'm so jealous. And she knows everything, and she's not telling anybody shit.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Everybody loves a good Fantastic Four movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the best Fantastic Four movie.
Good Fantastic Four movie being the... all right. So we talked about a few of those early superheroes. So who was the first supervillain? Kind of. It's the reason the cops started dressing in masks in the first place.
Is it the ghosts?
Nope.
I got another.
It's a gang. It's a gang, yes. Though, right?
It is a gang.
Gang. They weren't dressed as ghosts or clowns. Clowns or ghosts.
Nope.
Ghosts and clowns.
They clown weren't dressed as they
clowns.
Were they baseball players on roller skates?
Now we're
up. That was the Furies, and that was that Warriors.
But don't tell me the Warriors didn't have a little bit going on in this thing.
Probably.
Oh, yeah.
They weren't dressed as anything, Josh. They were naked. That's right. They were the naked gang. The naked gang would rob banks completely naked, and no one would look at them to give a description. And that was the first supervillain gang. Reread the comic book, guys. It's there. Because no one would look at them. No one wanted to see the naked giant men robbing the bank.
So were the ugly ones the most successful ones? Because if it was like one hot guy, wouldn't people be like, I remember that dude. Let's get a lineup going.
This isn't Porky's.
Josh?
Porky's too.
Josh, you know we love you and respect you. We care for you. If there's something you want to tell us right here, right now, that's great.
Hey, I don't know if it was a male gang or a female gang. You didn't specify.
It was a male gang.
Y'all know how Alan Moore writes. You know how that ended.
We know how that ended. All right. So we talked about some of the minor characters. We talked about the overlong story arc. So how did we feel at the end of this, and what is the implications for comic books moving forward? I think that this was an incredibly influential comic book. I think this was a definite step forward into comic books now playing in and doing more mature themes. That's hard to argue against that. I really think that this is one of the big lines in the sand. Yes, there is a mature audience for comic books. Everyone agree on that?
Yes.
For me, it's a visual manifesto of the escalation of violence, right? It's just showing the world that when at some point there will be an event or a adversary that is so horrifying or so unstoppable that the world must unite against it. And, you know, I mean, in modern times, let's just say that's climate change. You know, there's at some point the planet has to get together, everybody on it, and decide that as a civilization, as a race, we need to do the right thing. And that's Alan Moore's endgame for the whole thing is, right, is Ozymandias trying to trick the world into believing that they have to unite against something so horrific that if they don't unite, that they are all doomed. Now, and I'd have to say, and people are going to throw giant comic book spears at me till I die, that I like the ending in the movie better than I do in the comic.
No spear here. I'm one of the guys that also love the movie, but I love everything.
I just thought the ending of the movie was a more rational path to take than the giant tentacle alien.
Right.
Plus, it only attacked New York in the comic, right?
Yes.
How many of those things you think you could have made? It's a giant tentacle alien made out of, you know, that's tough. That's a tough get.
It was the teleportation. It couldn't put itself back together correctly. That's why everybody got sick when Dr. Manhattan would teleport them.
Plus, he had to use the brain of a powerful psychic. How many of those hanging around? Not enough, apparently.
Not enough, apparently.
Yeah, I agree with you on the whole, it's an allegory. I think the allegory here is nuclear war, which was, you got to remember, in 1986, 1987, it was a good possibility that at any moment the Soviets and the U.S. could go to war. And, I mean, I don't know if you and LT are old enough, but I'm sure Tom remembers. Oh. We used to do drills in our classrooms to hide underneath the desks in the case of nuclear war.
Oh, yeah. They had the turtle showing you how to hide under your desk.
Yeah. You remember that? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Get low, whatever it was. It was like a mantra, right?
All right. Yeah. It was ridiculous. Yeah. Like that desk in elementary school is going to save you from a nuclear blast.
That's right.
Yeah.
So full disclosure here, I was actually a nuclear weapons specialist when I was in the military, and I'm still terrified that it's coming. So you guys ready for your next trivia question?
Sure.
Where's the doomsday clock right now?
So is that at 4 minutes?
It was until Trump took office.
Ah, damn it. It's at three minutes now because of North Korea?
No, it's quarter past.
quarter past. We'd have a little bit more knowledge. Tommy, you said 2 minutes? Tommy,
you're
closest.
2 minutes.
2.5 minutes at the moment. And there's been some updates over the last couple of weeks. So 2.5 minutes. And for those of you not in the know, you know, the Watchmen, the Doomsday Clock plays a fairly large role in this, and that's how close scientists believe we are to nuclear war that'll lead into perhaps total annihilation of the human race. And at one point, we believed we were only 30 seconds away from, like, real nuclear war.
That was the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? That's as close
as we got. Yeah, the Cuban Missile Crisis was as close as we got. That was a pretty intense time.
Side note. People who say nuclear drive me insane. That's another one of my things where I'm just like, oh my dear God, stop that.
That's never bothered me unless they have control of a nuclear weapon.
Well, there's a lot of people who do.
Yeah.
Who say the word nuclear.
Yeah.
People out there, if you say the word nuclear, you're just adding a letter to a word that just doesn't have it. It's not there. It's just I don't even know where you're getting it from.
Yeah, I don't know personally, but I've read the biography of Mattis, and I've read the biography of a couple other generals that are around Trump, and I'm almost positive they gave him a suitcase with a watch and a walkie-talkie taped into it, and that's what Trump carries around.
And it's a Spider-Man walkie-talkie, so it is pretty cool, though.
So I'm fairly certain they said we're not giving this clown this thing. Sorry to our far right listeners. Yeah. My apologies. I just don't think he has it. That is the capability of understanding the horror that a nuclear war would bring upon the world.
As long as it's not a nuclear war, I'm okay.
All right. Let's go to final thoughts then. Final thoughts on The Watchmen. I think we all agree that this is a must read. I put it way up there. I really think this is kind of a must read.
I think it does a fantastic job of putting you back into the mindset of the 80s, of the danger of the nuclear war. It really does really portray how it felt living through that decade, even though it was sort of an alternative history.
It does bring some of that paranoia and that claustrophobia straight to you.
I have to say, I love The Watchmen. For more contemporary readers, I will say possibly the art of Dave Gibbons might put people off a little bit. I'm not a huge fan of the book as drawn. And I'll say that a little bit about John Higgins too. The coloring and the art style might put people off a little bit as a modern reader. But in the same way that I think Stranger in a Strange Land is a must read, where people who read it now who have not been even close to the 60s might have some trouble with it, that the art style of The Watchmen might give a modern reader sort of a stumbling block for getting into this. But I say to them, ignore that. read the book in its entirety, read the documentation between books, and really try to understand the story of the Black Sail, and put some time and effort into this book because it is well worth it at the end.
Well said, my friend. I have to say the artwork in the miniseries are actually better, but the writing is shite. Mikey, what do you got?
I would say if you haven't read The Watchmen, you definitely should go read it. As LT would say, he can't recommend it enough. I posted that we were going to be talking about The Watchmen on Facebook, and I had a number of people convey that this is the best graphic novel they had ever read. And I had a number of people who aren't even normal comic book readers who also commented on it. So I think that's very telling for you out there. My wife owned a copy of The Watchmen before I met her. And she had it, and I was like, you have a copy of The Watchmen? She's like, of course I have a copy of The Watchmen. Who doesn't have a copy of The Watchmen? Which, from a non-comic book reader, I think is very telling how great a graphic novel this is.
So, Tom, right, you ready for your... Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to give you one more trivia question.
Okay.
Number one graphic novel taught in colleges. Go.
Watchmen.
Tommy?
Mouse.
Josh?
Yeah, I don't know. I might go with LT on this. Mouse.
Mouse is a great guess, and Watchmen's a great guess also. Fortunately, friend of the podcast has taken the lead. March by John Lewis.
Nice.
If you asked a couple years ago, 2 years ago it would have been Mouse, and a couple years before that it still would have been Mouse, but Watchmen's right up there. And that was just a quick internet search for me, so deeper delving might be needed, but that's what it says right now. There's also one that's kind of surpassing or number one, number two with a bullet that I've never even heard of, which is called This One Summer. So we might have to go look that up.
You were saying that you were not a fan of the Before the Watchmen series?
Not a huge fan. I like the comedian's backstory a little bit, though I think they let him off the hook a little bit by being such a friend of the Kennedys. When clearly maybe he wasn't. But maybe that's part of the whole thing.
Didn't he kill Kennedy?
Well, in the movie, but that's never shown in the book, really.
In The Watchmen, they talk about it.
They talk about it, but it's not for sure.
Oh, yeah, he totally
Though I
killed
think
Kennedy.
He killed, but I think he killed Kennedy. I mean, if you read the book, I think he killed Kennedy. In the... In the backstory, like, he likes the Kennedys. He's always talking about it. So they try to make this thing where... You know, he was ordered to kill, you know, one of the Kennedys, and he did, and he didn't want to, or something like that. I'm like, that's bullshit. I don't think I buy this. I like the Silk Spectre. I liked Ozymandias's hero's journey, you know, becoming the world's smartest man and learning all these martial arts. It reminded me a lot of Year One for Batman, but I didn't love them. They just didn't ring true to me.
So for our listeners who don't know, they had 8 different Before the Watchmen series, so if you want to go check them out, they're available in graphic novel. Also, the movie, as you know, Josh mentioned earlier, is phenomenal, and HBO is going to have a television show based on the Watchmen coming up.
Ooh, that'll be great.
And right
now, and we haven't talked about the Button yet.
Well, the Button was the precursor for a series that's going on right now. The second issue just came out today. It is called The Doomsday Clock, where we follow some of the heroes from the Watchmen universe as they travel into the DC universe. I don't want to give away any spoilers, but it's quite interesting, and it's being written by Geoff Johns, who is amazing, and they are doing it in the style of the Watchmen, so every page is the 9 panels.
I'm sorry, Geoff Johns, isn't that the Martian Manhunter?
No, that's John Johns.
I was close. All right, well, usually we do front of the long box and back of the long box and tangents, but this is an insanely long podcast. You guys think we should skip that this time? Maybe go to plugs? Let's go to plugs. One thing we'd like to plug is we're coming to New Orleans. Now, we don't have panels this time, but we are going to have a lot of time to meet and greet our fans out there. So we'll be at New Orleans Comic Con. If you'd like to talk to us at New Orleans, just give us a tweet on our Twitter page, which is at the Long Box Guys. Or you can also email us at luckybastard@thelongboxguys. And just tell us where you're going to be and what your costume will be. And we're going to have a drink with you. That's right. This is an open invitation to every single fan to get us to buy you a drink. And we've been challenged to a drinking contest while we're there. Sammy Savage, you pretentious bastards. You think you can outdrink us? You poor saps. We're going to annihilate you. Has anyone played Drinking Quest? Maybe we should play Drinking Quest against them.
I haven't played Drinking Quest, no. But I certainly sound willing.
All right, Drinking Quest is a little bit like Munchkin with shots.
As long as the instructions weren't written by Alan Moore, I'm in.
Just the forward.
Not even the forward, mind.
And the backward. And then the forward again. It's a rape joke. Don't tell me they're not funny.
They're not funny.
Fine. And, yeah, so we're going to be down in New Orleans. That's going to be great. We're going to be in Pensacon, where hopefully we're going to have multiple panels, including our good friend Tony Isabella has deigned to talk with us on a panel, one of the first ones he'll be doing in 2018, which is exciting because this is the year his television show, Black Lightning, is going to be hitting the CW, and we're all, like, giddy with anticipation over this thing. It's getting great reviews, too.
And in honor of this podcast, I will be wearing a T-shirt that says, Quis adite ipsos longus arca archivir? Who listens to the long box, guys?
Oh, would you totally make that T-shirt?
Please come find me.
Please come find us. Rescue us, because we didn't get picked up for panels and we're sad and we need drinks.
Well, I would like to thank Kirby Crackle for providing us our geek rock music. You can check him out at kirbycracklemusic.com, or you can download him straight from iTunes or Bandcamp.
LT, anything to plug?
Well, if you haven't gotten your tickets for Wizard World New Orleans, don't use Longbox 20 because that code hasn't been working. Use NOLA 20 instead for 20% off. Because Wizard World has not been able to get the Longbox 20 code to work, and we've heard from numerous fans about that code, so use NOLA 20 instead.
And NOLA is the nomenclature for who?
The NOLA nerd couple.
We love those guys. Those are like our second. They're tied for – they're all tied for second favorite podcast. The NOLA nerd couple are hilarious. A lot of fun, and they've been on panels with us, right?
Yes, they have. And
We love these guys.
Yeah,
we should see the NOLA nerd couple want in on the drinking contest.
Mrs. NOLA nerd is pregnant, so probably shouldn't have her on.
Probably not.
Do you know how much more a pregnant woman can drink? She's drinking for two.
She's going to lose.
She's got out.
And I'd also like to thank GeekOrthodox.com.
GeekOrthodox.com. GeekOrthodox.com.
Purveyor of fine geeky stuff. LT, what kind of stuff do they have?
They have stained glass prints, Johnny Skywalker rocks glasses, fun, amazing geeky t-shirts, prints. You name it, they got it.
And last week I gave you crap because I said it was Geek Orthodoxy. You were right. It is Geek Orthodox. I was so wrong.
GeekOrthodox.com.
I had no idea why you thought it was Geek Orthodoxy.
I don't know.
Josh, you know, I hear you have a neighborhood.
Shut up.
Josh, I hear you have a neighborhood comic book store, and I've heard that the place is somewhat tidy.
It is. Friendly Neighborhood Comic Books in Bellingham, Massachusetts. If you have been there before and you try to go there again, you're at the wrong end of the plaza because they've moved a few doors down to a bigger location. And I can't judge whether or not that spot's clean yet because, you know, they're still probably tidying up. But they'll get
is Alan Moore doing a book signing there? Because that sounds awful.
As long as they don't put a sign out front that he wrote, I'm okay with it.
Well, he's got to write a signature in every book. Tyler Rapes.
Don't have him sign it. Just shake Alan man's
Moore,
hand and walk away.
My penis is in you. Thanks for coming. Alan Moore, my penis is in you. Thanks for coming.
I'm not sure that's how it's going to go.
Alan Moore.
And if Alan Moore is listening, we do love your writing, so please continue to write more comics without rape scenes.
Now, what are we going to do next week?
Black Canary.
All right, good call.
Okay.
I know who I'm going to shout out next time because we haven't done one of these in a while. All right, Black Canary, I like that. Mike, what is this podcast like to you?
It's like Drunk History, but for comics.
That's awesome. LT, any parting words?
We are still looking for sponsorship. So once again, for the cost of less than a cup of coffee a day, you could sponsor the Long Box. Sally Struthers, if you're out there, you could support us if you wanted to. And Stop Saving Children, you could save a podcast instead.
Who thinks of the old white men? For God's sakes, think of us. Josh, now we're going to be in New Orleans. We're going to be at a certain bar. What's the name of that bar, Mike?
Johnny White's.
Johnny White's. We're going to be stationed pretty much at Johnny White's. That must be. Please tell me it is.
Johnny White's is my sector. And look for the Long Box t-shirt. Find us and we'll buy you a drink.
Well, find us and we'll buy you a drink. We're also going to be going to wherever Emily Rolden, a friend of the podcast and frequent contributor, is. She has a great blog called The Femme Fatale. She's a bartender down in the French Quarter, and we are going to get so drunk talking to her because she's such a great super fan, so much fun to be around, and we can't wait to see you. Emily, we're coming. We're coming for you. And don't forget what I always say. Don't diss what you hate. Just promote what you love. You're going to live a lot longer. So long from the Long Box, guys.
We melt the highway miles away like sunfire. No stopping tonight. A double, double, the only thing that can break our stride. Forger a blast and we're rocking the blues. The dark night we're flying with nothing to lose. The wind whipping by like a banshee scream. The tail lights are dragging like omega beams. On the road, we're going home to the place where wild nerds roam.
It looks dark. Like, light doesn't seem to be escaping the mug. It seems to be drawn in.
That's because I have my leather on the glass. My leather handle. Oh.
That's one of your Christmas presents, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's it. I'm glad you're holding that up for the podcast viewers to see.
Yeah.
It's making it, so old man Tom could see it on the video.
Yeah. I got four pairs of glasses on.
There's no way you could make that large enough for him to see it.
That's true.